This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Deep, Deep Snow, written by Brian Freeman, performed by January Lavoie.
For Marcia. The first thing you should know about me is that I believe in signs, omens, premonitions. I grew up believing that things happen for a reason. That's the only way to explain why I'm alive. You see, I've spent a lot of time thinking about who I am because I don't know where I came from. I'm a mystery to myself. I was born in late October or early November, but I don't know the exact day. When I was 5 years old, I picked October 31st for my party. Halloween. I thought that would make for a cool birthday. Whatever the real day was, I was left on Tom Ginn's doorstep when I was about a week old. His house used to be a church with a white steeple and a wall of stained glass windows. At night, in the darkness, my birth mother probably thought it was still a church, and I guess that's where you take a baby you're planning to abandon. She left me in an old Easter basket, strangely enough, nestled among green paper curlicues like a white chocolate bunny. I was dressed in a cotton onesie with faded pink stripes and a bonnet with flaps tied in a bow under my chin. The temperature outside was 39 degrees. Obviously, I don't remember that night, but sometimes I think about what it must have been like to be alone, freezing, crying, with no idea what I had done to be cast away. She left no note to tell me why. Tom Ginn wasn't home at the time. He was 40 miles away, night fishing under a cloudless, moonless sky in his favorite spot on Shelby Lake. You don't realize how many stars hang in the heavens until you experience one of those nights. Tom had a tent set up on the shore and a portable propane grill for cooking whatever he caught on the lake. It was a Saturday, his first night off in 4 weeks, and he was planning to camp on the beach until morning. If he'd done that, I would have died. Either the cold would have killed me, or an animal would have dragged me off. The woods near us are filled with wolves, raccoons, bears, and wolverines. We even have a mythical monster called the Ursulina that many townspeople swear is no myth. Any one of those predators would have torn a little baby limb from limb and consumed me. Thinking about it still makes me shiver. Tom had no idea of the danger I was in, or that I was there at all. He was enjoying the night on the placid water. The air was fresh and sweet, tinged with the scent of pine. His boat was at the mouth of a cove between the trees where it was utterly still. There was just him, the lake, the wilderness, and the stars. It's a big, big place that makes you feel small. He was sipping hot black coffee from a thermos and jigging for walleye. He'd been out there for an hour without any luck, but he was in no hurry. That was when God sent him the sign. Like an angel, a snowy owl swooped down from the treetops and landed on the other end of the boat. Tom was so shocked that he couldn't even take a breath. His mouth hung open with a jug of coffee at his lips. The owl perched there and watched him with its stoic, unblinking eyes. Its head was a perfect white, its body checkered over with white and gray. Breaking the silence of the night, the owl squawked out a loud, raspy call. When Tom didn't answer, the owl called to him again and again, each time with an urgent impatience. To Tom, the owl's cry sounded like the same word over and over. Home. Later, he would say that he knew this was no ordinary moment in his life. He would tell everyone that it wasn't just the owl calling to him. It was me.
Okay, he announced finally. Okay, I'm going.
The owl unfurled its wide wings, soared into the sky, and vanished. Right then and there, Tom brought the boat in and packed up his camp. He drove the 40-mile trip along the two-lane highways faster than he'd ever driven in his life. He had no idea what was waiting for him, but when he got home, there I was, screaming to the world, blue with cold. He never located whoever had left me there. My mother was long gone. When he didn't find her, Tom Ginn, the 30-year-old, never-married, youngest-ever sheriff of Middle County, adopted me. He named me not after himself, but after the place he'd been when God brought us together. Shelby Lake. That's me. Tom became my father, and he raised me. You won't be surprised to learn that he has always been my superhero, my whole world, my idol, my life. I worshiped that man from the time I could walk. You also won't be surprised to learn that I've spent many of my free hours at the local Raptor Center, volunteering with the injured owls who are brought there for rehabilitation. Growing up in Middle County, I knew that I would be a police officer like my father. I was already helping the secretary, Monica Constant, answer the phones in the sheriff's office by the time I was 13 years old. It wasn't the life my father wanted for me. He thought I should go to college, leave this remote wilderness behind, and chase other dreams far from home. But my choice was to stay here and follow in his footsteps. That's what I did. I'll be honest with you. I've always felt a little guilty that I was alive at all. I mean, God went to an awful lot of trouble keeping me here, right? When I was a girl and my father told me about finding me on his doorstep, I asked him, "Why me? I'm nothing special. Why was I saved?" He told me that was something I would have to figure out for myself, even if it took me a long time to do. And he was right. All these years later, I finally have an answer that I can live with. But that's the end of the story. I need to take you back to where it started. The mystery began 10 years ago on July 17th, a perfect summer afternoon. I was 25 years old back then. That was the day another snowy owl appeared in my life, like the return of a messenger. To me, the arrival of an owl could mean only one thing. I was being called to rescue a child. Part 1. The Unwanted Visitor. Chapter 1. On the day that Jeremiah Sloan disappeared, I was teasing Monica Constant about her dead dog. That sounds cruel, but you have to understand that Monica's Alaskan Malamute had died 9 years earlier, after a long and very pampered life. She cremated Moody, which isn't unusual, but she kept his ashes in a flowered urn that she took with her to work in a special purse every single day. Vacations, too. If you asked her why, she would explain that if she left Moody at home and her house burned down, then she would have no way of differentiating between the ashes of her house and the ashes of her dog. Monica wasn't about to take any chances. And yes, I would tease her about this whenever I could. On that particular July afternoon, my partner, Adam Twilley, was leaning against the open door that led to the parking lot with a cigar between his lips. My father couldn't see him, which was the only reason Adam felt bold enough to smoke in the office. The warm wind blew in and sprayed a plume of ash from the end of his cigar onto the yellowed linoleum floor. "Monica," I called, pointing to the little gray sprinkle of ash. "I think Moody needs to go out." To her credit, Monica always giggled at my lame jokes.
"Shelby, what am I going to do with you?"
she said with a little shake of her head, using the same grandmotherly tone she'd used with me since I was a girl. Monica and I went way back. It's a little weird when you work with people who used to change your diapers. She joined the sheriff's department as a secretary right out of high school and had never worked anywhere else over the past 3 decades. That's the thing about a small-town place like Middle County. Loyalty runs deep in these parts. When you find your place in the world, you stay there. She went back to reading us the latest police reports out loud. Adam and I were both in our chocolate brown uniforms. Normally, we would be out on the roads together, but it had been a slow Friday so far. I was only half paying attention to what Monica was saying, because my father was in his office behind closed doors, and the muffled conversation inside was getting loud.
"Oh, this is sad," Monica announced in her high-pitched twitter of a voice as she squinted at the computer screen. "Poor old Paul Nadler wandered away again in Stanton. They want us to be on the lookout for him."
Adam snorted from behind his cigar.
"On the lookout? Stanton is an hour away. Nadler is what, 94? Do they think he's running a marathon or something?"
"Come on, Adam," I chided him. "The man has Alzheimer's."
"Yeah, I know, but this is like the sixth time he's walked out of that care center without anybody noticing. Somebody either needs to bell that cat or figure out how to lock the damn door."
Adam was right about that. Stanton was in the next county over, so it really wasn't our problem. But I felt sorry for Mr. Nadler, and angry that the senior facility couldn't keep him safe. They typically found him within a couple of hours, but a lot can happen to an old man in that amount of time. Once he walked into a stranger's house two blocks away and fell asleep in a closet. Another time, he actually climbed the 100-foot Stanton Fire Tower. Sooner or later, he was going to get hurt. "Let's move on, Monica. What else is on the list?" I was a little too brusque with her, but Monica gave me a sympathetic smile from the other side of the room. She could read my mind. I wasn't upset about Mr. Nadler's memory problems. I was worried that someday I would find myself in the same situation with my father.
"We've got a report of a stolen pickup truck in Martin's Point," she went on. "A white Ford F-150. That is such a nice vehicle. I've always wanted one of those."
I grinned at the idea of tiny Monica Constant driving one of the world's largest trucks. She rattled off the license plate, and Adam and I scribbled it down in our notebooks. This was the fourth stolen vehicle report this month. It was summer. Cars around Middle County had a way of going on joyrides when kids were off school. Martin's Point was a lakeside town 50 miles south of us, which meant it attracted tourist families with bored teenagers who quickly discovered that the locals don't always lock their vehicles. "Anything else?" I asked.
"Oh, yes. Mrs. Norris says she saw a man skulking outside her bedroom window last night. According to her, he was, quote, ogling her lasciviously while in a state of undress."
"A state of undress?" I asked. "Was he undressed or was she?"
"I think she was."
"So we're looking for a blind man,"
Adam joked from the doorway.
"That should make it easy."
I couldn't help laughing. Adam was right about that, too. Nobody with good eyes would be ogling Mrs. Norris. Did she give a description of the man?
No, she didn't see him. Her bedroom window was open, and she says he was making some kind of snuffling sound, like heavy breathing. She thinks he came from the motel across the highway.
All right, we'll wander over there later. I'm sure Rose won't be surprised at another complaint from Mrs. N about one of her guests. Is that all? It didn't matter if that was all. Before Monica could say anything more, the door to my father's office flew open with a bang, interrupting us. I saw a slim, tall, annoyingly attractive woman in the doorway, and she saw me sitting at my desk. "Violet," I said coolly.
"Shelby,"
she said with equal frost in her voice. Violet Rocha and I had been frenemies since high school. My one claim to fame in Middle County, well, other than being the baby in the Easter basket, was being part of the girls' volleyball team that won the state championship in my senior year. Believe me, that's a big deal in a small town. There's still a billboard about us on the highway. Violet's family moved to the area when she was a junior, and she promptly went out for the team and squeezed out my best friend, which didn't help us get along. She and I became the two biggest rivals with the two most stubborn personalities, but Coach Trina had managed to get it through our heads that we could accomplish more together than apart. The truce lasted until we brought the trophy home. Since then, we hadn't exactly been close. At 26 years old, she was a newly minted lawyer who'd already gotten herself appointed to the county board after one of the members resigned in the middle of his term. One thing Violet never lacked was ambition. She'd been using her newfound clout to hassle my father about everything he was doing wrong as the county sheriff. I didn't like it one bit, but Dad let it roll off his back the way he did everything in life. Violet didn't linger in the office. She shrugged a purse over her shoulder, clicked across the floor in her sky-high heels, and pushed through Adam's cloud of cigar smoke into the parking lot. Adam gave her one of his crooked James Dean smiles, but Violet didn't swoon. When she was gone, my father strolled into the common area to join us. Adam quickly flipped his cigar to the asphalt outside and hummed an innocent tune. "What did Violet want?" I asked.
"Oh, she always has something to complain about," my father replied with a wrinkle of his bushy mustache. "Apparently, now I'm not doing enough to combat climate change."
"What exactly can you do about that?"
"As you'd expect, Violet had a list prepared."
"Was there anything else?" I said. "It sounded like the two of you were arguing."
"It was nothing, Shelby. Don't worry about it."
My father was the most honest man I knew, but that also meant he was a bad liar. I didn't know what he and Violet had been arguing about, but it was more than climate change. Whatever it was, he chose not to share it with me. Dad wandered over and perched on the side of Monica's desk, where he perused the summary of police calls.
"Mr. Nadler again? I can't believe they keep losing that man."
Then, without looking up, he continued,
"Oh, and Adam, was that a cigar I saw in your hand?"
"Definitely not, Tom," Adam replied, although he wasn't fooling anyone because the smell had already permeated the basement.
My father sighed and shot me a sideways glance.
"How about we solve a little crossword puzzle for Adam, Shelby? Let's try this one. An unwanted visitor in a tableware emporium. Four letters."
Dad loved crossword puzzles. He and I had spent 20 years doing them together over breakfast in the local cafe. His clue took me just a moment to figure out, and then I said, "Bull." Because a bull in a china shop would definitely be an unwanted visitor.
"You got that, Adam?"
my father said with a wink.
"Bull."
Adam stared at his feet and coughed.
"Sorry, Tom. No more cigars in here, got it? Let's try not to burn down another building."
"Yes, sir."
Monica and I both covered our smiles. That was my father. He never needed to yell or shout or throw his weight around to get what he wanted. He had a way of charming you even as he made you feel like dirt for disappointing him. His voice was soft, like piano music, which sounded strange coming from such a big man. He stood 6'2" with a shaggy head of snow-white hair and a mustache that kept growing out of control like a weed. Even during the winter, his skin had a deep, leathery tan. His build was bulky and broad-shouldered in a way that sent a quiet message of strength. Anyway, now you've got the picture. That was July 17th. A slow day. The four of us were in the Middle County Sheriff's Office, located in the basement underneath the town's Carnegie Library. It was an old space, cold in the winters, humid in the summers. We could hear the thunder of children's running footsteps overhead. The linoleum peeled at the corners. The ceiling tiles were water-stained. For me, that particular moment will always be stuck in time. Me at my desk, Dad and Monica with the police reports in hand, Adam in the open doorway. That's how it was when the world changed.
"Wow, will you look at that?"
Adam suddenly said. He squinted into the sunshine in the library parking lot and shook his head with a kind of awe. I asked him what was up, but Adam looked transfixed by whatever he saw and didn't say a word. We all converged on the doorway, and I got there first. The sight took my breath away. Outside, not even 20 feet away, Adam's motorcycle was parked in the lot. Perched atop the bike's side mirror was a snowy owl. Motionless. Serious. Regal. Staring at it, I felt the strangest, coldest sensation down my entire body. "It's just an owl," I found myself murmuring out loud, because we lived near the National Forest, among predators and prey. There wasn't anything especially unusual about a snowy owl taking a rest before flying back to the trees. Except at that very moment, the phone rang on Monica's desk. We all jumped at the noise, and the owl took flight with a cry. Right then and there, I knew. Something had happened. Monica skittered across the floor with her short little steps and grabbed the phone. She wasn't much bigger than a bird herself. She listened to the voice on the line and was barely able to get in a word because I could hear a panicked woman shouting at her through the receiver. When Monica hung up, I looked at her, waiting. So did Dad and Adam.
"That was Ellen Sloan," she told us. "Jeremiah is missing. She thinks someone took him."
Chapter 2. Dad led our parade of vehicles down miles of dirt road into the heart of the National Forest. Adam and I followed, with me at the wheel. Dennis and Ellen Sloan brought up the rear, and they had Adrian, Jeremiah's 16-year-old brother, in the car with them. This was a lonely place for a 10-year-old boy to vanish. The town where we live is named Avery Ware, but long ago people simply started calling it Everywhere. This being Middle County, we say we live in the middle of everywhere, but the truth is that we're closer to the middle of nowhere. The deer outnumber the people around here by a significant multiple. We're still ahead of the wolves, but they're gaining on us. We are surrounded by hundreds of square miles of woods, creeks, and lakes, and the nearest interstate highway is 2 hours south. Our towns are spread out by dozens of miles, and they have great names: Witch Tree, Eagle Ridge, Martin's Point, Blue Diamond Lake. We were 30 miles north of Everywhere when I saw the cloud of dust settling as Dad's squad car slowed and stopped. Not far ahead was a child's bicycle, tipped forlornly on the shoulder of the road in a nest of thistles. The blue frame was caked with dirt. In the forest on either side of us, dense stands of paper birches and white pines fought for sunlight. The July air was sticky and warm. Insects whined from inside the tangled brush, and songbirds danced back and forth across the road in flashes of color. My father got out of the cruiser and assessed the bike with his hands on his hips and his mouth crushed into a dour frown. His brown, flat-brimmed sheriff's hat was securely placed on his head. The mid-afternoon summer sun was high and bright, but the denseness of the woods meant you couldn't see far through the shadows. It had been dry that week, so the ruts in the dirt road showed no tire tracks or footprints. The bicycle was the only evidence that a boy had been here. Adam and I joined Dad on the road. So did the Sloanes and their oldest son. I knew the Sloanes well in those days. Everyone did. Despite how spread out the people of Middle County are, there are 0 degrees of separation in an area like ours. We know each other's stories and secrets, probably more than we should. When you all grow up together, it's also hard to get past who you were in high school. No matter what you go on to do in life, you're still the baseball star, the homecoming queen, the party girl, the volleyball champ. The Sloanes had that problem. People talked about Dennis and Ellen like they were still Jack and Diane from John Mellencamp's little ditty, but that wasn't fair. Dennis had a master's degree in forestry management. Ellen had bought the failing market on Everywhere's Main Street and turned it into a moneymaker. Ellen was 36 that year, 2 years younger than her husband. She was smart, cool, blonde, blue-eyed, tough enough to make a shoplifter confess with nothing but one of those icy stares of hers. She was the strong one in that household. That was what made it so hard to see her struggling to keep it together. I saw the tremble in her fingers. I heard her breathing, which was quick and loud, through her nose. She kept touching her hair and pushing it back in place, as if that were the only thing she could control at that moment. Her life was her two boys, and one of them was gone. My father put a hand on the shoulder of Jeremiah's older brother and gave the teenager a reassuring smile. Adrian was a meaty kid on the high school football team, but at that moment he looked as if the slightest breeze would knock him down.
"So, is this where you found your brother's bike?"
Dad said.
"Yeah."
"Did you move it at all?"
"No, I didn't touch it."
"Did you search the woods around here?"
"Yeah, sure I did. Jer wasn't anywhere."
Dennis Sloane muttered an expletive under his breath and marched to the side of the road, his boots crunching on rock. He didn't have the patience to stand around answering questions. He cupped his hands around his mouth and bellowed into the woods with big pipes that would fill a room.
"Jeremiah! Jeremiah!"
His booming voice scared a few birds, but that was all. There was no answer. That didn't stop him from hollering again. He was a handsome park ranger with the strong physique of a lumberjack, and strong men always labored under the illusion that they could solve any problem if they swung a little harder, talked a little louder, or ran a little faster. Life didn't work that way. My father let Dennis shout himself hoarse. Then Dad went on in the same level voice he always used. Panic was boiling over on that road, but my father was an oasis of calm, like the eye of a storm.
"Adrian, why don't you tell us what happened?"
The teenager kicked at the dirt with his sneaker.
"Jer and I went to work with Dad at the ranger station. We hung out there most of the morning, and then I figured I'd ride my bike for a while. I was going to go by myself, but Jer threw a fit about coming with me. So I let him go along just to shut him up."
"Why didn't you want him to come with you?"
Dad asked.
"I like to ride fast. He slows me down."
"What did the two of you do?"
"Nothing. We rode, that's all. I thought we could make it to Talking Lake, but we didn't get that far before we got hungry. There's a campground about a mile north of here, so we stopped to have lunch. Mom made sandwiches for our backpacks. Jer wolfed his down and then he started bugging me."
"How so?"
"Oh, he was batting a shuttlecock around with his badminton racket. He'd whack it and chase it, and he nearly hit me with it a couple of times. It pissed me off. He was collecting rocks, too, and he had to show me every one he found. He wouldn't leave me alone."
"So how did the two of you get separated?"
"Jer wanted to go back, but I wasn't ready to leave. I mean, he made such a stink about coming with me, and then he wanted to head out before we did anything. I said, fine, go, I don't care. And he got on his bike and went back the way we came."
"You let him go," Ellen murmured to her son. Her tone was gentle, but the lack of anger in his mother's voice actually made the accusation cut deeper. I could see the kid folding up like a flower.
"You let your brother go. Alone. Out here."
Adrian bit his lower lip and looked miserable.
"All I did was give him a head start, Mom. I was going to catch up to him."
"Are you sure he headed south?"
my father asked, before Adrian disintegrated completely.
"Is it possible he went the other way, toward the lake?"
"No, I saw him go. He was heading toward the ranger station."
"Was there anyone else in the campground while you were there?"
The boy squatted to pry a few prickly burrs from the cuff of his jeans and flick them into the brush.
"No."
"What did you do next?"
"I hung out for a while."
"Doing what?"
"Shooting at the crows. Just to scare them. I didn't hit them or anything."
"You carry a gun?"
"Sometimes."
Adrian flipped back his windbreaker to reveal the butt of a revolver jutting out of the pocket of his jeans.
"Boys need to know about guns, Tom,"
Dennis interrupted, as if my father had been casting aspersions on his parenting.
safest thing is to teach them when they're young, you know that.
I do know that, Dennis. I'm just trying to figure out what happened. Did you ever let Jeremiah handle your gun, Adrian?
A couple of times, but only if Dad was around.
My father was silent for a while. That was one of the things he'd taught me about police work. Silence is your friend. People can't stand silence, and they feel like they have to fill it up with something. Usually, they end up telling you things they never meant to say. But Adrian kept his mouth shut.
Okay. Jeremiah took his bike and left, my father went on eventually. You were alone in the campground. Did you see or hear any cars on the road?
No.
What about voices?
No. I said I was alone.
How long did you stay there after Jeremiah left?
I don't know. A while?
5 minutes? 15? An hour?
I told you, I don't know. I wasn't looking at what time it was.
But eventually you got on your bike and headed back the same way?
Yeah.
Okay. Tell me the rest.
The teenager heaved a sigh.
I found Jer's bike. He was gone. I don't know anything else.
Did you move the bike at all? Is this exactly where you found it?
My head snapped up, as if someone had jabbed me with a live wire. I'd been on edge for months, watching for little things like that. I wondered if anyone else had noticed that Dad was repeating himself. Adrian did. He looked puzzled and annoyed.
You already asked me about that.
Dad's composure broke for a moment, but he recovered with an easy smile.
Just making sure.
Well, I didn't move it,
Adrian said again.
What did you do next?
I looked for Jer. What else? I looked everywhere. I shouted and shouted. I rode back to the campground to see if I'd missed him somehow. Then I started back toward the ranger station. I figured maybe he was walking, like the bike crapped out or something, and I'd pass him on the way, but I didn't. I rode all the way back and told my dad.
You have a phone, right? Why not call?
Signal sucks out here. Anyway, I was too freaked. I just wanted to get back and tell my dad.
Did Jeremiah have a phone with him?
Yeah, but it was dead.
He's always forgetting to charge it,
Dennis interjected.
I called it over and over. It keeps going to voicemail. Well, we'll check with the phone company and see if they can tell us anything,
Dad said.
Adrian, what was Jeremiah wearing?
His Sunday suit.
My father's brow furrowed in surprise.
Really? Why?
Ellen was crouched by her son's bicycle on the shoulder of the road. Her fingers reached out and touched the front tire and spun it slowly. She spoke without looking up.
We lost my father a couple of weeks ago. Jeremiah was very close to his grandfather, and he took it hard. He wore the suit to the service at the cemetery, and he's been putting it on ever since. I tried to make him stop, but after a while, I just let him do it.
He wore Nikes, too,
Adrian added.
Purple ones.
Okay. Adrian, is there anything else you can tell us?
No, nothing. Really. I don't know what happened to him.
He shot a pained look at his mother.
I'm so sorry, Mom.
Ellen didn't look back at her older son. She stood up again, brushed the dust from her clothes, and fixed her stare on my father. Her voice was barely a whisper, but she hammered out every word.
Someone abducted my boy, Tom. You need to do something right now. I want roadblocks, helicopters, alerts in every police department throughout the state. I want my son's picture on TV. I want him on highway signs. I want the whole world looking for Jeremiah.
She was barely holding back the hysteria that I knew was inside her. It was like lake water thumping against the surface ice trying to get out.
Ellen, none of us will sleep until we find your boy,
Dad assured her. He drew himself up to his full height, and when he was like that, you just had to believe everything he said.
I know you're scared, but there hasn't been a stranger abduction in this county ever. Ever. It's easy to think the worst, but let's focus on the likelier explanations first. We need to search the woods around here. If Jeremiah left the road for any reason, he can't have gone far. We'll put out the word and have 50 townspeople here in a few minutes, and we'll blanket the whole area. We've got hours of daylight left to find him. It's also possible, likely even, that Jeremiah simply hitched a ride back to town with somebody he knew. He could be at a friend's house right now. Kids don't think about the panic they cause when they forget to tell their parents where they've gone. Shelby and Adam will check the whole town while we're out here searching the woods. Okay? Trust me. We'll find him.
I knew my father believed that. If I'd been in his shoes at that moment, I probably would have said the same thing. You try not to make promises you can't keep, but Dad still believed that most stories had happy endings. Someone in town would find Jeremiah. Some hero would take him home, and Ellen would cry, and Dennis would hug his boy, and the rest of us would exhale with quiet relief. That was how we all thought it would go. The boy would be back in his mother's arms by nightfall. But we were all wrong. Chapter 3. 10 years old. That was Jeremiah's age. I still remember what it was like to be a kid in the summertime in Middle County. When I was that age, I used to do exactly what Jeremiah did. Take my bike down the dirt roads with my hair blowing in the wind, ride to one of the dozens of lakes around here, and swim in the cool water with fish brushing up against my bare legs. Those days felt like they lasted forever. The sun came up early and went down late. When I finally got back home, I'd be wet, dirty, tired, and ready to do it all over again. Rose Carter was my best friend back then. Rose was the girl who got booted off the Everywhere Strikers when Violet went out for the high school volleyball team. It wasn't my fault, but Rose and I were never as close after that. I think she held it against me that I stayed on the team. But when we were 10, we did everything together. I would make up puzzles and mysteries for us. She and I would hike into the woods to hunt for signs of the mythical Ursulina. We'd find what looked like footprints in the mud, and we'd measure them and take pictures and bring them all back to my father to show him what we'd found. He would swear that our evidence was very, very persuasive, and we believed him when he said he would consult with people in the government about what we'd discovered. Rose and I explored the whole county in those days. We went everywhere, just the two of us, and the Ursulina was the only monster that ever crossed our minds. We didn't worry about being alone miles from home. We never imagined a bicycle lying on the side of the road. 10 years old. Dad used to keep a picture of me on the mantle from when I was that age. Hands on my hips, hair in my face, annoyed and impatient that I had to take a break for even a moment from the whirlwind of being a child. I suppose every parent has a picture like that. If I look in a mirror even now, I can still see hints of the girl in that old photograph. I haven't lost that faraway look in my brown eyes or the stubborn crinkle in my forehead. I was a medium girl then, and I still am. Not short, not tall, not heavy, not thin. My hair looks dark enough to be black, but you'd have to see me in the sunlight to know it's more like chocolate. It's straight as an arrow, even on the most humid July day. I keep it parted in the middle and just long enough to frame my face. I have a few freckles, too, sprinkled like pepper across the bridge of my nose. When I look at that picture now, I think, that girl wasn't afraid of anything. It's hard to find things you like about yourself, but I'll go with that one. I don't scare easily. 10 years old. It can be a dangerous age. You're not just a little kid anymore. You're starting to become a person, but you haven't lost the wonder of being a child. You have no sense of your own limitations. That's a good thing and a bad thing. I thought about Jeremiah at that age, trying to figure out the world. I knew him better than I did most kids in the area because his best friend and next-door neighbor was Anna Helvick. Anna was the daughter of my friend and former volleyball coach, Trina,
and I was over at Trina's house all the time. Anna and Jeremiah were often with us. He was a shy kid, not saying much when you talked to him. Anna was the brave one, like me, the girl who would go anywhere and do everything. Jeremiah looked happy to trail behind her and play Spock to her Kirk. He was sweet, always with a big smile, the polite kid who called me Miss Lake. I liked him. Where was he? I kept going over Adrian's story in my head. I thought about Jeremiah heading out of the campground on his bike. I tried to picture this short, skinny boy flying down the road through the national forest, his little legs pumped up and down on the pedals, and his backside probably lifted off the bicycle seat. His badminton racket jutted out of his backpack. His hair whipped like strands of fine straw, long enough to fall over his eyes, with a cowlick sprouting from the back. But you know what really struck me? That Sunday suit he was wearing. They'd put Jeremiah's grandfather in the ground 2 weeks earlier, and this little boy still couldn't take off his Sunday clothes. I didn't know if it would help us find him, but it told me one thing. Jeremiah was lonely. That's what worried me. Because if I could see it, then so could others. The ones who saw a boy like that as prey. Chapter 4.
So what do you think?
Adam asked me as we drove back toward everywhere.
Where's the kid?
I didn't answer immediately. I was watching a caravan of cars pass us in the opposite direction, filled with searchers ready to fan out shoulder to shoulder to hunt for Jeremiah in the woods. They were our friends and neighbors. Around here, when someone's in trouble, the word goes out and people drop everything to help. I hope he's in town with a friend, I said finally, and we just haven't found him yet. Adam took off his sunglasses and waited until I turned my head and stared back at him.
Shelby, you know he's not in town.
He might be.
Without his bike? How did he get there? Somebody had to drive him, and by now the whole town knows he's missing. If anybody knew where he was, they'd have called. The fact is, he's either still in the forest or else...
I waited. Or else? Adam shrugged and replaced his shades on his face.
Hey, you're thinking what I'm thinking, you just don't want to say it.
He was right. I didn't want to say it, so I said nothing. We drove on in silence. It was 10 more miles before we reached the southern border of the National Forest. Dennis Sloan worked at the ranger station and welcome center at the park entrance. There was a stop sign ahead of us marking the main highway cutting through Middle County. Going left would take us east towards Stanton, an hour away. Going right led toward block-long towns like Witchtree and Sugar Fall that were situated deep in the kind of woods where Goldilocks got lost. The checkerboard streets of everywhere were directly ahead of us. Century-old brick buildings lined the main street, which was dominated by the county courthouse and its acre of green lawn and historical statues. Next to the courthouse was the boxy library that housed the sheriff's office downstairs. The rest of the street was made up of shops that had been around for years. The small market owned by Ellen Sloan. The bakery with green frosted sugar cookies that have always been a weakness of mine. The hardware store. The post office. The Nowhere Cafe, where Dad and I ate nearly every day of our lives. You can imagine the jokes. Where do you eat and everywhere? Nowhere. Some of the shops had closed over time, leaving empty buildings with rusted signs and broken windows covered over with plywood. It's like a funeral for a friend when a main street shop closes, because you know it's never coming back. This isn't a place where new customers come to live and shop. Every census report whittles down Middle County by another few hundred people. Either they die or they leave for better jobs and bigger towns. People aren't having enough babies to compensate. Adam and I parked outside the Nowhere and then went door to door into all of the shops. It took less than an hour. No one had seen Jeremiah that day. Searching the outskirts of town was going to take longer, because most neighbors lived half a mile or more from each other, in houses carved out of a few acres of forest, with long dirt driveways winding through the trees. I drove toward Jeremiah's house, but Adam stopped me when we were barely out of the town center. He grabbed my arm and pointed at the parking lot for our one-story K-12 school, home to the Everywhere Strikers. I'd gone there. Adam had gone there. We'd all gone there. It was summer when kids wanted to forget about school, but there was a beat-up red SUV parked in the far corner of the lot.
"I recognize that Bronco," Adam said. "The Gruders are back."
I groaned. Will and Vince Gruder were our local bad boys, the ones who kept the county flush with drugs. Think they know something?
"I think we should ask."
I pulled into the lot and parked our cruiser next to the Ford Bronco. Adam and I both got out. The SUV's rear windows had been covered with duct tape, so we couldn't see into the back. Hundreds of bugs were splattered across the windshield, and the front seats were a mess of fast food wrappers and Walmart bags. A plastic jalapeno wearing a sombrero dangled from the rearview mirror with "Welcome to El Paso" printed across the green skin of the pepper. I knew what the jalapeno meant. Will and Vince traveled to Mexico every summer, and they cooked what they brought back into meth in a lab hidden somewhere in the woods. We'd chased them for years, but they were sly as foxes about covering up their business and had never spent so much as a day inside the Middle County jail. There was no sign of the Gruders outside the school, but I heard the springy thump of a basketball behind the building. Adam heard it too, and he headed off across the green grass without a word to me. I jogged to keep up with him. I was used to Adam taking the lead. Technically, he and I were both deputies, but he was 3 years older. You can guess where that left me in the pecking order, at least in Adam's mind. It didn't help that I was the daughter of the sheriff. It also didn't help that Adam had asked me out in high school when he was a senior and I was a freshman, and I'd shot him down. Adam didn't hear the word no very often. He was used to girls falling for the jeans, the shades, the smirk, and the tight little curls in his short brown hair. He wasn't tall, but he had the cool factor going for him back then. Cool kids weren't my type. Not that I knew what my type was. Adam was a good cop, but a little reckless, because he always felt like he had something to prove. He'd grown up in the shadow of his mother, who was a local hero in Middle County. She'd competed in the Winter Olympics in Lake Placid and taken home a silver medal in cross-country skiing. She was pretty and TV-friendly, and she'd parlayed her success into a lot of money in sponsorships. Sooner or later, Adam was going to inherit some big bucks. Maybe that's why he never looked happy living an ordinary life. I think he always felt that his mother wanted him to do something more with her DNA than hand out traffic tickets on the county roads. The two of us went around to the rear of the school building where the athletic fields were arranged in a giant rectangle. The basketball courts were closest to us, and we saw the Gruders playing a fierce game of one-on-one with a white and purple basketball. As I watched, one of the brothers sunk a hook shot through the rusted hoop, but I didn't know which brother it was. They were identical twins, 22 years old.
"That's Vince,"
Adam said, reading my mind. "How do you know?"
"Because Vince can shoot and Will sucks."
We strolled over to the court. The Gruders saw us coming and they dribbled the ball to the fence to meet us. Both wore jeans and high tops, and both were bare-chested, with sweat dripping in streaks down their suntanned skin. They had the same long, greasy blonde hair and the same green eyes, and even the same nose rings in their right nostrils. They were tall and skinny, and I could smell pot on their breath.
"Deputy Twilly,"
Vince announced, as if we were all old friends.
"And Deputy Lake. Look at that. Our two favorite law enforcement professionals are here to welcome us home. You want to shoot some hoops with us?"
"When did you get back into town, Vince?"
Adam asked, ignoring the small talk.
"A couple of days ago. We rolled into Witch Tree late on Wednesday.
Where did you go on your trip?
Oh, here and there. We hit us some beaches, drank us some beer. What's summer without a road trip, right? Still, there's no place like home. Nothing beats the scenery around here.
As he said this, Vince gave me an up-and-down look that belonged in a brown paper wrapper.
We're looking for Jeremiah Sloan, Adam said impatiently. Have you seen him?
Vince bounced the basketball in his hand.
Who?
He's Adrian Sloan's little brother, I told him. I noticed that Will Gruder kept scratching his leg with his foot, and I shot a quick glance at the ragged cuffs of his jeans, which were loaded with sharp little prickly burrs. When I saw that, I quickly added, I mean, you guys know Adrian, don't you? The two brothers exchanged looks, and the look from Vince said, shut up.
Sure, we know Adrian, Vince said. Football player, right? What's up with his brother?
Jeremiah is missing, Adam replied. We found his bike on the dirt road that leads to Talking Lake. There's no sign of the boy. His parents are pretty worried.
Will shot a concerned glance at his brother.
He's missing? Really? I mean, we just...
Hey, that's too bad about the kid,
Vince interrupted before Will could say anything more.
Wish we could help you out, but we haven't seen him. If we spot him hanging around, we'll give you a call.
When did the two of you last see Adrian? I asked. Vince didn't blink. He just stared right through me.
Adrian? Heck if I know.
Are you sure you didn't see him today?
Today? No, we haven't seen Adrian since we got back. Not sure why we would. You guys need anything else? Or can I get back to kicking Will's ass on the court?
Go ahead. Vince grabbed his brother's shoulder and dragged him back to the basketball court. I waited to see what Will would do, and sure enough, he glanced back at me with a shifty, nervous expression that told me the two of them were lying. I turned my back on the brothers and walked away toward the front of the school. This time, Adam had to jog to catch up with me.
What the hell was that about?
He asked.
Why were you asking about Adrian?
Burrs, I replied.
Huh?
Will had prickly burrs stuck to his jeans and shoelaces. A lot of them.
So?
Adrian Sloan did too. He was picking them off while Dad was talking to him. Adam looked back at the brothers, who were hanging around on the court and watching us go.
You think the Gruder brothers were with Adrian? Because of a few prickly burrs? That's pretty thin, Shelby.
Yeah, I know. Maybe I'm wrong about this and it's nothing. But if I'm right, then Will and Vince saw Adrian in the National Forest today. And that means Adrian's lying to us. Chapter 5. When you're in the midst of an investigation that involves a child, you always feel as if your heart is in your mouth, and you have to remind yourself to breathe. So it was a relief when Monica called us to say she had a report of an unidentified, unaccompanied minor in our old town cemetery. I told her we'd check it out immediately. My first thought was that Jeremiah had gone to visit his grandfather's grave, and I allowed myself to hope that our fears had been misplaced, and we'd have the boy back with his parents soon. The dead of the Middle County Cemetery have always been like friends to me, because the graveyard backs onto our house. When I was a girl, I used to wander the cemetery trails at night with a flashlight, hunting for ghosts. Rose thought it was creepy and wouldn't go along, but the place never bothered me. Remember, I'm the girl who doesn't scare easily. I still walk in the cemetery whenever I can. Sometimes I'll take my guitar and sing songs for the dead, because they're good listeners and don't heckle me when I'm off key. Adam and I parked in the driveway of my father's house, then we hiked through the backyard toward the cemetery. The burial plots are clustered in small groves, with spruces watching over the dead like silent giants. Moss and mold adorn the older stones, some of which date back 200 years. Even on the hottest, brightest summer day, it's cool and dark there, and you can't see far because of the tree trunks packed closely together. I called, "Jeremiah? Jeremiah, are you here?" Adam shouted too.
"Jeremiah! Hey, Jeremiah, can you hear us?"
We didn't get any reply except the trill of cardinals. "Let's split up," I suggested. Adam took a path to my right, and the woods quickly swallowed him up. I went in the opposite direction. Every now and then, I called Jeremiah's name again. Distantly, I could hear Adam doing the same, but after a while, his voice faded away. The cemetery meanders over acres of hilly land, and as I explored the individual groves, I saw winged angels, crypts guarded by carved lions, fallen crosses, and massive trees toppled by storms, with mushrooms growing out of the stumps. The whole area had a peaty smell. I'd walked these trails countless times and knew many of the names on the graves by heart. But this time, I felt an odd sense of unease being here. That's because I knew I wasn't alone. Someone was in the trees, spying on me. Every now and then, I heard a twig snap, betraying a footstep. It could have been an animal digging in the leafy brush, but I didn't think so. I kept looking over my shoulder, but the trails were empty, and I didn't see anyone near the graves. "Hello?" I called. "Who's there?" There was no answer, so I tried again. "Jeremiah? Is that you? Come on out, I know you're there." I kept walking, but when I glanced back, I spotted a tiny flash of yellow disappearing behind the trunk of a black oak. It was someone wearing a hoodie. Small, definitely a child. I couldn't see a face, but whoever it was knew they'd been spotted. I heard my stalker sprinting away and I took off in pursuit, but I was chasing someone with the grace and speed of a deer. Little stabs of yellow whipped in and out of view through the trees and left me behind. "Hey! Hey, stop!" I broke into a field of headstones scattered along a shallow hillside. Shadows stretched across the lawn and the forest itself was gray. My spy in the hoodie had vanished. If it was Jeremiah, he wasn't wearing his Sunday suit anymore.
"Shelby?"
Deputies aren't supposed to scream, but I screamed in surprise. Someone was right behind me. I whirled around, and the man who was there backed away, raising his hands as if to assure me that he came in peace. I knew him. Oh, yes, I knew him. He was just about the last person I wanted to see. "Keith." He stood there, looking as awkward as me. His lips moved, but he didn't say anything, as if his mouth didn't know what to do. Talk? Smile? Frown? Kiss me?
"Long time,"
Keith said finally. You'd be amazed how much meaning you can pack into two little words. We could both tell you the exact date when we'd last spoken. November 14th. Last fall. "What are you doing here?" I asked him. He nodded his head toward a flat stone on the ground, newer and brighter than the weathered graves around it.
"Colleen."
"Oh, sure."
"I suppose that surprises you."
"Why should it? She was your wife." Keith tossed his head, flipping back his messy brown hair. It was a nervous gesture he used a lot. He was lanky and tall, wearing khakis, old brown shoes, and a rust-colored pullover. He limped when he moved because he had an artificial limb below his right knee. He wasn't classically handsome, but handsome faces have never been that interesting to me. His face had character, like a book that offers you something new every time you read it. His eyebrows were thick and dark, his nose long and slightly crooked, his chin narrow and protruding. He and I had the same kind of eyes, colored like raw brown sugar, and a little sad. Whenever I looked in his eyes, I knew there was a lot going on inside. Keith Whalen. He was 8 years older than me. When I was a senior in high school, he taught my English class. I know, what a cliche, the girl with a crush on her English teacher. He read Thoreau and I swooned. Yeah, that was me, but it's not that simple. We'd all heard stories about his injury in the war, his mood swings, his opioid habit, his troubled marriage. I didn't see any of that in the classroom. I just saw a broken man sitting on the desk, taking us all to Walden Pond with that Tupelo Honey voice of his. To me, if he had personal struggles, that only made him more attractive, and I was the teenage girl who could fix it all. Don't worry, it was nothing more than a Harlequin romance fantasy in my head. Nothing happened when I was a student. But dead fires have a way of coming back to life. So, how are you? I said. Keith shook his head the way he had when one of my answers disappointed him in class.
Do you really care how I am, Shelby? If you're just making small talk, we don't need to do that.
I care.
Okay. Sorry, I suppose that sounded harsh. It's just that the last time we talked, I thought that you...
Don't misunderstand me, I interrupted with coolness in my voice. I'm still a police officer. Nothing's changed. But you asked me if I care, and I do. He got a little tick in his cheek. I knew I'd hurt him. I was trying to hurt him.
You're honest,
he said.
I guess I prefer that. Well, since you asked, the fact is I'm not doing well at all.
That's too bad, Keith.
You may not think I loved Colleen, but I did. I miss her. And yes, I know she was a better wife to me than I deserved.
He eyed the grave, as if Colleen were still listening to him.
You know, I've picked up the phone 100 times to call you, Shelby.
It's better that you didn't.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I never told anyone. Your secret is safe. I mean, I assume you wanted it to be a secret.
I don't want to have this conversation, Keith.
Okay, that's fine,
he said. But I could sense his disappointment.
What about you? What are you doing here?
Jeremiah Sloan is missing. Didn't you hear about it?
No. Town news doesn't come my way like it used to.
Well, we had a report of a kid here in the cemetery. We were hoping it was Jeremiah. Have you seen him? Keith hesitated.
No, I haven't. At least I don't think so.
You don't sound sure.
Well, someone was around here. I don't know who, but somebody was watching me from the trees when I was talking to Colleen.
Yellow hoodie?
That's right. I didn't see a face.
Keith flipped his hair again. I made him uncomfortable.
What happened to Jeremiah?
I explained, and his face grew cloudy.
You think he was abducted? Around here?
He asked. I'm trying not to think about it. I'm just trying to find him.
Well, I know Jeremiah likes to go off by himself and explore. I've seen him on my property a few times this year. Mostly in the woods, but he would come up to the house and barn, too.
Oh? Why?
I don't know. He didn't say anything when I tried to talk to him. Ellen and Dennis only live a mile away. I just figured he was out hunting for the Ursulina.
I stared back at him with a frown on my face. I didn't like the joke. Not from him. Not after what had happened.
I suppose I should check in with Dennis and see how he's doing,
Keith went on,
but he and I don't really talk much now.
Why is that?
Colleen worked for Ellen at the mini-mart, remember? Ellen's not exactly a fan of mine anymore.
It doesn't matter. Right now they need all the support they can get. If you want to call Dennis, you should.
I will,
he said. I need to go, Keith.
Sure. Good luck. I hope you find Jeremiah soon. I mean, I'm sure he's okay and all, but it's rough when a kid is missing.
I didn't say anything more. There was a lot I could have said, but I didn't. When I looked at Keith, I remembered coming out to the cemetery last winter with my guitar and singing that Sheryl Crow song, My Favorite Mistake. I turned away and hoped we were done, but I knew he couldn't let it go. I hadn't gone 10 feet when he called after me.
Hey, how come you never asked me the question, Shelby?
Tom asked me. Adam asked me. You never did.
I stopped and let him stare at my back.
Is it because you were afraid of what I'd say?
He pressed me. My shoulders heaved with a sigh. I turned around and faced him again. I didn't ask because I knew what you'd tell me, and I figured I'd know if you were lying. I didn't want to have to live with that. Keith closed the distance between us with a little sway in his hips from his artificial leg. He didn't look surprised by my doubts.
Well, I'm sorry to put such a burden on you, Shelby, but I want you to hear it from my mouth. I'm telling the truth. I didn't kill my wife.
Chapter 6. I had to put the confrontation with Keith out of my mind because I found the grave of Jeremiah's grandfather in the same grove where Colleen Whalen was buried. There were footsteps in the newly turned dirt, but they looked crusty and dry, dating back to the interment 2 weeks earlier. No one had been here recently. I was disappointed because I realized that Jeremiah probably hadn't been the child lurking in the cemetery grounds. My little fairy in the forest hadn't gone away, however. I was still being watched. When I started up the sloping trail that led back toward our house, I saw a dot of yellow come and go behind a fat old beech tree that the locals called Bartholomew. I walked quickly to get ahead of whoever it was. Where the trail crested the hill, I was invisible, so I darted off the path and took cover. Soon, quick footsteps rustled through the brush in pursuit.
Gotcha!
I exclaimed as I jumped back on the trail. A 10-year-old girl froze in front of me. She was dressed in a yellow hoodie, jean shorts, and sneakers. She was tall for her age and skinny as a pencil. When she pushed the hood from her face, her sunny blonde hair came free, and she stared up at me with huge blue eyes.
Hi, Shelby.
Anna Helvick, what are you doing here? It's not safe to be skulking around the woods. You shouldn't be in the cemetery by yourself.
Wow. Did I sound like a mother or what?
I suppose I was as close to a surrogate mother to Anna as she was likely to have. I'd been there for her first steps. I'd babysat for her whenever her parents were away. When her mother Trina had gone to Chicago for cancer treatment 5 years earlier, I'd been the one to move into their house for a month to take care of Anna. It was the least I could do.